We all love stories. Some stories just simply entertain. We get done. Sometimes we call them beach reading. We get done with them and toss the book over to a friend and say, I think you'd like it. And then they read it and they throw it to somebody else. So there's that kind of reading. It's light, it's fluffy, and nothing wrong with it. But sometimes stories have important messages. Sometimes the stories are all about the messages. And there's a category of these kinds of stories, allegories, fables, and parables. These are stories that are meant to reveal some truth, and that's their primary purpose. I would say allegories are much more, well, let's see how we put it. It's a one-to-one relationship of everything in the story standing for something else. Everything has an importance. If the number 6 comes up, that means something. If a man is riding a horse, that means something. The horse represents something. The man represents something. If he's reading a book, that represents something. Everything has a one-to-one correspondence. So allegories fit into this kind of teaching device. They're not very popular anymore. I think about Pilgrim's Progress as a good example of an allegory. Long time ago, the story of the Christian's attempt to reach heaven and the people and the places that he runs into along the way. Some of the places, one of the places that's become very familiar is called Vanity Fair. It's where people go and waste a lot of time. I think it's interesting that they've actually got a magazine now called Vanity Fair, which seems like a put-down, but oh well. Well, other stories that do that kind of teaching would, one other type is called a fable. And I'm sure you're familiar with some of the Aesop's fable stories, the fox and the grapes, the famous one of the tortoise and the hare, and there's dozens and dozens, the ant and the grasshopper. And usually they illustrate, again, some sermon, some advice for life. Well, parables fit into the same category. Parables are stories that Jesus taught all through the New Testament Gospels. And I wanted to turn to one of them and have you think about that for just a minute. It's in Mark chapter 4. And Jesus is going to tell a famous story called the parable of the sower. So let me read it to you, and then there's a reaction afterwards that I also wanted to read. So it says Jesus is teaching by the lake, and the crowd is so big he has to get out into a boat, and so now he's talking to the people, and here it is. Verse 2 of chapter 4 in the Gospel of Mark, he taught them many things by parables, and in his teaching said, listen, a farmer went out to sow his seed. As he was scattering the seed, some fell along the path, and the birds came and ate it up. Some fell on rocky places where it did not have much soil. It sprang up quickly because the soil was shallow. But when the sun came up, the plants were scorched and they withered because they had no root. Other seed fell among thorns, which grew up and choked the plants so that they did not bear grain. Still other seed fell on good soil. It came up, grew, and produced a crop, multiplying 30, 60, or even 100 times. Then Jesus said, he who has ears to hear, let him hear. So in other words, there you go, figure it out. Well, we read that story, very typical of a parable, and I want to read more parts of it in just a second. Why do you think it was a good teaching device for Jesus? And why do allegories and fables occupy the same area? What popularity, why are these things popular? Well, I would suggest that they represent reality. They give us real people doing real events. In this case, a lot of farming activities will show up in parables. They're not religious, right? Religious stories turn people off. Nobody wants to hear that kind of stuff because it makes us uncomfortable, too much like a sermon. In addition, I think it's the simplicity. There's simple action in here. Somebody's just out sowing seed. So we can all appreciate that. It's a way to focus. These stories also arouse curiosity. We're wondering what's going to happen next. Think about the Good Samaritan story. People come along. His audience expects these people to come along, this man who's been injured, that they will get help for him. But they don't. And there's suspense. Is anybody going to help this poor guy? Now, in this story, we have all this negative stuff, right? The birds eat it. Some fall in rocky places, and others on among thorns. And so all these things, we're waiting to hear the good news at the end. Also, many of these stories use foils, which are, I think we talked about that before when we were looking at stories. They use contrasting characters. It forces us to take sides. You know, for example, in the Good Samaritan story, we had the ones who refused to help the man versus the one who did help the man. We have the foolish women versus the wise women. We get an unjust person, a good, just person. We get people that don't use their money right and do use their money right. And so we're forced to look at these stark differences, these contrasts, and make our choice. A lot of repetition in here. There are usually 2 to 3 to 4 in a series, like the grain. It falls in 4 different types of soil. They're universal kinds of characters, again, usually agricultural. So that would probably help explain the popularity. But I wanted to go beyond that and have you take a look back to Mark 4. I would say all of these things are in here as well. But watch what happens when Jesus is finished and he's talking to just his disciples. This is verse 10 back in chapter 4 of Mark. So when he's alone, says the 12 and some others ask him about the parables. You know, what's going on here? He says, the secret of the kingdom of God has been given to you, but to those on the outside, everything is said in parables, so that, and then there's a quote from Isaiah, they may be ever seeing but never perceiving, and ever hearing but never understanding, otherwise they might turn and be forgiven. So now, you scratch your head and you thought, well, wait a minute. I thought the purpose of a parable was to help us understand God, salvation, the role of Jesus, the way people live their lives. Isn't that the purpose? But Jesus said, there's something else going on here. It says, to those on the outside, right? So the ones that are looking in or are considering Jesus, the message of Jesus. So for those on the outside, these parables are, in a sense, a test. So they can listen to that story and they can decide one of two things. They can say, oh, this sounds important. I think we're talking about God. I think we're talking about salvation here. I need to hear more. And they close in on Jesus to hear more of what he has to say. But there are others who are going to hear this message and going to say, this sounds like a lot of work. I have to interpret all of this. Why can't this be more plain? I don't need this. And they walk away. So I would say we're finding a parable as a cloaking device. How much do you want to know about the kingdom of God? A young man comes up to Jesus, a rich young man one time, and says, what do I need to do? And Jesus sees that he's a really honorable guy, and he ticks off a few things for him to do. And the young man says, I've done those things. And then Jesus says, and here comes the test, sell everything you have and follow me. Now, do we have to do that today? Is that the message to Christians? I would say no. I think this is just part of this idea that Jesus expressed here, that he puts tests in front of people. It's a cloaking device. So that's interesting, I think, that he approaches parables that way. Something else I find interesting about parables is the way they have punchlines. What do I mean by punchlines? Well, let's look at the story of the Good Samaritan one more time. Luke 10. It's a gotcha kind of story. Many times these parables are gotchas. Here's the parable of the Good Samaritan. Who's my neighbor? Okay, so that's the key question that sets Jesus off in this story. Who's my neighbor? Now, obviously, this guy is thinking somebody close, maybe down the street, maybe same skin color, whatever it is. Who's my neighbor? And then Jesus tells the story. A priest and a Levite. These are two people high up in Jewish society. So if you're the listener and you hear this story about a priest coming along and a Levite coming along, you think, oh, they'll help. These are people I admire. Today, I don't know who'd be in our society. We're such a negative society. Who are honored individuals? Maybe some clergy individuals. Maybe ones that work in soup kitchens. Those who give to the poor, whatever it is. And they come along, and Jesus surprises us. They do not help. In fact, they go, it says they pass by the other side. So they go out of their way to avoid him. And then who comes along? A stinking, nasty, dirty Samaritan. Now, I'm just saying that to overkill this thing, but for a Jew, a Samaritan was a foreigner. He was a dog. He was somebody who was pretending to be a Jew, but he wasn't. The Jews used to walk out of their way so they did not have to enter Samaritan territory if they had to walk that direction. So there's where Jesus, in a sense, pulls the trap door for the people reading this story. They go, whoa, I wasn't expecting that. The ultimate enemy for me ends up being a good person. Of course, then the punchline of the story, Jesus says, so which of the three really was a neighbor? And this guy has to say, the one who had mercy on him. Notice he can't even use the word Samaritan. Yeah, that guy that had mercy. So to have to admit that the enemy you've grown up abhorring is actually the good person of the story has shock value. And we don't see that today because we haven't grown up in that attitude, but just tremendous shock value here. Let me take you to one other one that does that same sort of shock value, a very famous story. It's also in Luke 15. It's a story. Here we go. It's called the parable of the lost son, or we've probably heard of it as the story of the prodigal son. Now, you know most of the story already, so I'm going to go really quickly over it because there's a huge surprise at the end. It's a sweet story that the young son takes the money from the father, which basically says, I don't care if you live or die, I just want your money. So he gets the money and he heads off and he just blows it on terrible choices and has to come back hoping to be able to get some kind of menial job with his father. And his father rushes to him and celebrates and hugs his son, and they're going to have a tremendous party. And verse 24 of chapter 15 in Luke, for this son of mine was dead, he's alive again, he was lost and he's found, they began to celebrate. Now, why isn't that the end of the story? It could be. But here comes the surprise. Now, I want to read this. Remember, there are two sons. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. Your brother has come, he replied, and your father's killed a fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound. Well, aren't we waiting for the older brother to say, oh, I'm so glad. I'm glad to have my brother back. We'll have a great life together now with my father. But what do we get? Here comes the surprise. The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, isn't that interesting? He won't call him my brother. It's this son of yours who squandered your property with prostitutes comes home. You kill a fattened calf for him. My son, the father said, you're always with me and everything I have is yours, but we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours, remember, he's kind of echoing what the son had said before, this son of yours, this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And so I imagine, my guess is, the Jews were squirming a little bit because as they heard this story, they were probably expecting the father to say, when the son comes up the long walkway, probably to say, okay, you've messed up big time. I'm going to put you on some sort of probationary period. Let's see how it works out. And I'll grudgingly take you back into this family if you prove yourself. But this extravagance of the father would just amaze the Jewish people. And then, remember, they've judged this guy, this lost son. They've judged him just like the older brother did. And the older brother sounds stupid and petty here. So that must have made him uncomfortable because it really reflected their own pettiness as well. Well, before we end on parables, let me give you some good examples of ones that you might want to take a look at. We cover these more, of course, in the class. But there's the story of the two debtors, Luke 7, 41. There's the story of the pearl, Matthew 13, 45. We did the Good Samaritan, the marriage supper, that's Matthew 22, 2. Story of the lost coin, Luke 15, 8. The unjust steward, which I want to look at in a minute, that's Luke 16. The laborers in the field, Matthew 20, verse 1. The talents, Matthew 25:14. The wicked vine growers, that's Matthew 21:33. And the parable of the 10 virgins, that's Matthew 25:1. So I hope you take a look at those and enjoy them. So what I'd like to do is focus on just a few things to do with these parables before we walk away from the topic. One thing that makes me scratch my head, I want to go to chapter 16. One thing that makes me scratch my head is the second half of chapter 16, so I'll just get that out of the way right now. It's the story of what's titled The Rich Man and Lazarus. And it makes people uncomfortable because it talks about a rich man who dies and it says he's in hell at the end of the story. Well, a lot of people don't think of Jesus as talking a lot about hell, but he actually did. He spent quite a bit of time talking about it. So now people have a question about this. Is this a parable? If it's a parable, then we shouldn't believe that it's literally true, and then we can get rid of the worry about hell. The catch is, unlike the parables, did you notice something? It's not just the rich man. It actually names a character. That doesn't sound like a parable. Parables don't have particular names. So I'll just leave that to you. I'm just putting a question mark. Is this a parable? I don't think it is. Although, it comes in at the end of chapter 15, it has several parables. Chapter 16 starts with a parable. There's some teachings before we move to this. So a little ambiguous whether we have a parable or not. All right, let's go to, now those, a lot of those I read to you, the names of the parables, you said, oh yeah, I understand, I recognize those. But some make people a little uncomfortable, they're lesser known, and frankly, they're a little confusing. Let me take you, since you're in chapter 15 of Luke, let's go next door, chapter 16, it's called The Parable of the Shrewd Manager. And again, if that's okay, let me tell you the story. Chapter 16, verse 1, there was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and asked him, what's this I hear about you? Give an account of your management because you cannot be manager any longer. The manager said to himself, what shall I do now? My master is taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig and I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses. So he called in each of his master's debtors. He asked the first, how much do you owe my master? 800 gallons of olive oil, he replied. The manager told him, take your bill, sit down quickly, make it 400. Then he asked the second, and how much do you owe? 1,000 bushels of wheat, he replied. He told him, take your bill and make it 800. The master, now wait a minute, we should stop right there. Right? We should think about that. What's he done? He, in a sense, has ripped off his rich man, right? The person he's working for, he's ripped him off because these people have these legitimate debts to him and he's told them cut it in half. And yet, verse 8, the master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. Whoa, how's that for a trapdoor? Because I'm sure the people listening to the story are irritated and tisking as they hear about this dishonest manager. And he's even called the dishonest manager. Well, let's continue. Second half of verse 8. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourself so that when it's gone, you'll be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Okay, so I gotta admit, this is an odd one. If this is a parable, then certain characters in here should represent things. Is the master, the rich man, God? Could be. Who's the shrewd manager then? Is that Jesus that reduces the debts of all these people? Well, Jesus didn't just reduce debts. According to the Christian message, he got rid of the debts. Are the debts the law? Are the debtors that he goes to the human race? Well, I guess that's a way to read it. Except it seems odd. In verse 8, the dishonest manager, we don't think of Jesus is dishonest. Shrewd, yes. But so I got to admit, I'm scratching my head on that one. To me, I think the key there is, for the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light. So here's this guy scrambling around to save his last years of his life, right? He's working like crazy. He'll cut every corner possible. He's desperate. And Jesus is saying, people will be so desperate in this world to save a few bucks and they don't even think about the next world that's coming up. We should be even more desperate. We should even be more shrewd. We should do everything it takes, put all our energy into finding out what it takes to survive in the next world and to prosper in the next world. So I think there's the lesson, but you can understand if you read a parable and you're looking for some kind of one-to-one relationship, you can end up scratching your head big time on that. How should we approach a parable to understand it? Well, we want to read for the literal story. You know, there's this guy and he gets beat up and these two guys come along and a Samaritan comes along and you go, oh wow, Samaritan. Sometimes you can look for symbols. Certain symbols get used repeatedly. Usually we have an owner and a vineyard, and that usually ends up being God owning the vineyard, being the world, or even maybe the Jewish people, and try to figure out the theme of the story. Who are we supposed to appreciate? Who are we supposed to root for? Since we're talking parables, let me share something with you here that I thought was pretty funny as a way to end here. It's called The Teacher Versus the Administrator. Now, you know that I'm a teacher, and it's you know who's going to win this tug of war. And I'm not saying necessarily I buy into this, but I just think it's a pretty good parable. A man in a hot air balloon realized he was lost. He reduced altitude and spotted a woman below. He descended a bit more and shouted, "Hey, excuse me, can you help me? I promised a friend I'd meet him an hour ago, but I don't know where I am." The woman below replied, "You're in a hot air balloon, hovering approximately 30 feet above the ground. You're between 40 and 41 degrees north latitude and between 59 and 60 degrees west longitude." "You must be a teacher," said the balloonist. "I am," replied the woman. "How did you know?" "Well," answered the balloonist, "everything you told me is technically correct, but I have no idea what to make of your information. And the fact is, I'm still lost. Frankly, you haven't been much help so far." The woman below responded, "You must be an administrator." "I am," replied the balloonist. "How did you know?" "Well," said the woman, "you don't know where you are or where you're going. You've risen to where you are due to a large quantity of hot air. You made a promise that you have no idea how to keep. You expect someone else to solve your problem. And the fact is, you're in exactly the same position you were in before we met, but now, somehow, it's my fault." Okay, I don't know if you'd heard that one before, but I thought that was funny. Next time, we'll take a look at epistles as a form of literature.